December 21st, 2018, Pat Buchanan. Will Trump hold firm on Syrian pullout? We have defeated ISIS in Syria, my only reason for being there, wrote President Donald Trump as he ordered the withdrawal of all U.S. forces from Syria, stunning the U.S. foreign policy establishment. Trump overruled his secretaries of state and defense and jolted this city in capitals across NATO, Europe, and the Middle East. Yet, Trump is doing exactly what he promised to do in his campaign, and what his decision seems to say is this: we are extricating America from the forever war of the Middle East so foolishly begun by previous presidents. We are coming home. The rulers and peoples of this region are going to have to find their own way and fight their own wars. We are not so powerful that we can fight their wars while we also confront Iran and North Korea and face new Cold Wars with Russia and China. As for the terrorists of ISIS, says Trump, they are defeated. Yet, despite the heavy casualties and lost battles ISIS has suffered, the collapse of the caliphate, expulsion from its Syrian capital Raqqa and Iraqi capital Mosul, and from almost all territories it controlled in both countries, ISIS is not dead. It lives on in thousands of the true believers hidden in those countries, and, like Al-Qaeda, it has followers across the Middle East and inspires haters of the West living in the West. The U.S. pullout from Syria is being called a victory for Vladimir Putin. Russia, Iran, Assad are ecstatic, wails Senator Lindsey Graham. Graham is echoed by Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse, who called the withdrawal a retreat and charged that Trump's generals believe the high-fiving winners today are Iran, ISIS, and Hezbollah. But ISIS is a Sunni terrorist organization, and as such, it detests the Alawite regime of Bashar Assad and Hezbollah and Iran, both of which are hated by ISIS as Shiite heretics. Russia, Iran, Syria are not happy about us, about the U.S. leaving, Trump tweeted, despite what the fake news says, because now they will have to fight ISIS and others who they hate without us. If Putin, victorious in the Syrian civil war, wishes to fight Al-Qaeda and ISIS, the last major enemies of Assad in Syria, why not let him? The real losers? Certainly the Kurds, who lose their American ally. Any dream they had of greater autonomy inside Syria, or an independent state, is not going to be realized. But then, that was never really in the cards. Forced to choose between Turkey, with 80 million people, and the second largest army in NATO, which sits astride the Dardanelles and Bosphorus entrance to the Black Sea, and the stateless Kurds with their Syrian Democratic Forces, or YPG, Trump chose Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And Erdogan regards the YPG as kinfolk and comrades of the Kurdish terrorist PKK in Turkey. A week ago, he threatened to attack the Kurds in northern Syria, though U.S. troops are embedded alongside them. What kind of deal did Trump strike with Erdogan? Turkey will purchase the U.S. Patriot anti-aircraft and missile defense systems for $3.5 billion and probably forego the Russian S-400. Trump also told Erdogan, "We would take a look at extraditing Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen, who Erdogan says instigated the 2016 coup attempt that was to end with his assassination." National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said U.S. troops would remain in Syria until all Iranian forces and Iranian-backed militias have been expelled, appears not to have been speaking for his president. And if the Israelis were relying on U.S. forces in Syria to intercept any Iranian weapons shipment headed to Hezbollah in Lebanon through Damascus, then the Israelis are going to have to make other arrangements. Well, that's the real kicker here. here, folks. That's the real read between the lines, is the Israeli reaction. They are not happy. Continuing on, the War Party project to bring about regime change in Tehran through either severe sanctions leading to insurrection or a U.S.-Iranian clash in the Gulf will suffer a severe setback with the U.S. pullout from Syria. However, given the strength of the opposition to a U.S. withdrawal, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the GOP foreign policy establishment in Congress, and the think tanks, of course, the liberal interventionists in the Beltway press, Trump's own national security team of advisors, the battle to overturn Trump's decision has probably only just begun. From FDR's abandonment of 100 million East Europeans to Stalin at Yalta in 1945, to the abandonment of our nationalist Chinese allies to Mao in 1949, and of our South Vietnamese allies in 1975, America has often been forced into retreats leading to the deaths of allies. Ben Sass says Trump is risking the same outcome. Quote, "A lot of American allies will be slaughtered if this retreat is implemented." End quote. But is that true? Trump's decision to pull out of Syria at least has assured us of a national debate on what it will mean to America to extricate our country from these Mideast wars, the kind of debate we have not had in the 15 years since we were first deceived into invading Iraq. There you have it, folks. That's Pat Buchanan on Trump's decision to withdraw 2,000 troops, and I'm sure military equipment and assets. Well, maybe not. Maybe I did see a story that we're leaving behind some weaponry and taking advice on who we're going to leave it to. So, there you have it. All the people in the alternative media, all the truthers, who Donald Trump is owned by the Jews. Well, if he's so owned by the Jews and he's so owned by Israel and Netanyahu, and who else is still alive over there? Ehud Barak, Ehud Olmert, Shimon Peres, is he still alive? Anyway, if Mossad, if Trump is so owned by the Jews, why is he pulling out of Syria? Do you think Israel really wants U.S. troops and the American military to leave the Middle East? Or do you think the Israelis want us to continue to fight and slaughter Arabs to pave the way for greater Israel? It's pretty obvious, folks. Trump is doing what is in the best interest of the United States. He's channeling John F. Kennedy with this move, in my opinion. He is going on the pull down. JFK wanted how many thousands of troops? I forget the number, 5,000, 10,000, whatever it was, withdrawn and at home by Christmas. And of course, John F. Kennedy didn't live to see Christmas, did he? Lyndon Johnson immediately reversed that order days after, I think it was November 29th, 1963, 7 days after Kennedy is shot dead in Dallas. Folks, Donald Trump, dare I say it, Donald Trump is JFK. He is doing what is in America's best interest, and he will do some liberal things if he really thinks there's something to it and it's going to help, like this criminal justice reform. He'll get behind it. We don't deserve this man, is what I'm saying. Given the country that we have and the people that we have and all the people in Washington, D.C., the American people do not deserve Donald Trump. He's too good for us. This man is putting everything on the line to do what's in the best interest of the country and the people. And he's not letting Israel dictate foreign policy. He told Bibi, we just gave you guys $35 billion. We give you all these billions of dollars, if not hundreds of billions of dollars, every year. I gave you Jerusalem as a symbolic capital of Israel. He did token airstrikes on Syrian installations, Syrian targets, two times already. Two separate incidents, he sent missile strikes. What more do they want? And you remember the report back from September that Haaretz reported, and some other Israeli sites, that Trump said, there was a report out of the White House that Trump said Israel and the Jews are not grateful enough for what he's done for them. Trump knows, folks. He knows. Why do you think the establishment is so hell-bent on getting rid of Donald Trump? You think the Israelis aren't playing into that? You think they aren't feeding that narrative that Donald Trump is a tool, is a puppet of Putin and the Russians? Folks, the Israelis aren't happy with Putin and the Russians because Putin and Russia are backing Bashar al-Assad, who Israel wants to topple and has wanted to topple for what? 17, 18 years now. They wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein. They didn't give a goddamn what was going to happen to Iraq after that. If these Arabs all killed each other, these different Muslim, Shiite, Sunni, Alawite, Kurd, they didn't care if they slaughtered each other. And if they did, all the better for Israel. They wanted Saddam Hussein gone. They want Bashar al-Assad gone in Syria. They want Syria toppled. They want Hezbollah and Lebanon wiped out. Who else was on the hit list? Iran, obviously. They want Iran gone, even though they gave Iran basically Iraq to operate through after they toppled Saddam. The Shiites are now the majority faction and have been in Iraq, even more so back 15 plus years ago. But who else? North Korea. Why do they want rid of North Korea? They're afraid North Korea, being a big technology implementer and weapons technology developer, they're afraid that North Korea is going to support the Palestinians and Hezbollah groups who resist Israeli occupation. That's why they want North Korea gone. Libya, they already got rid of Muammar Gaddafi and destabilized Libya and shipped all these millions of North Africans and Asia Minor, Middle Eastern, the Gog-Magog War flooding into Europe to kill true Israel, white Christians. We hit Libya. Sudan was also on the list. I guess there's some African countries that are Muslim extremists and pose a threat to Israel. Folks, this is what the whole thing is about. The war on terror is a fraud, and it's to get the United States to be the battering ram, the cannon fodder, the mercenary, to go wipe out the Middle East and make it safe for Israeli occupation. That's what this whole thing is. And no one has ever had the courage, has had the testicular fortitude to tell you what the agenda is. All these goddamn people in the media, all these people lying about wars for oil and it's about empire. No, these are wars for Israel. Plain and simple, and they want American servicemen and servicewomen to go serve, occupy, fight, die, get limbs blown off, and have their lives and families ruined, all for the state of Israel. That's what the whole thing is about. It's a giant fraud. And how did they get the American people behind the war on terror? Well, folks, you ought to know the answer to that question. How did they get everyone stirred up back in the early George W. Bush first term? 9/11, the new Pearl Harbor to catalyze the country that Bill Kristol and PNAC and Charles Krauthammer and Wolfowitz and Wormser and Feith and Abrams and Cohen, Richard Pearl. How convenient that the al-Qaeda terrorists, bin Laden and Mohammed Atta, how convenient that they serve up the Israelis exactly what they want, an excuse to start a war in the Middle East. Hasn't that always struck you as a little too convenient, looking back? Sure bothers me when I look back on it. And I'll tell you what, if you believe the official story of 9/11, then guess what you also have to acknowledge? You have to acknowledge that Osama bin Laden is perhaps one of the greatest, probably not better than Mao Zedong, but is one of the greatest guerrilla strategists, guerrilla fighters, resistance fighters of the 20th century. Maybe the 21st century, too, depending on how you want to look at it, with us getting in these wars in the Middle East. He baited the United States into coming into the Middle East and get bogged down and spend trillions of dollars and waste their empire on trying to occupy Asia Minor in the Middle East. You have to acknowledge that if you really believe Osama bin Laden was behind 9/11, you have to acknowledge that. And yet, no one ever does. It's incredible. Well, that's the first story that we had on the Syrian pullout. We got a whole laundry list of stories to go through here, and we are only, 15 minutes into this broadcast? So we got more to cover. We absolutely got more to cover. Where's my other stories? Producer, bring me my stories. Secretary, can I get some more coffee in here and bring me my stack of stories? All right, where's our next story? Trump not up to the role of president. John Kelly gives dramatic exit interview. This was published today, the 31st, New Year's Eve, on Zero Hedge. Gotta love Zero Hedge. Here's an update. Shortly after the LA Times published this article, the New York Times published a similar piece recapping the LA Times story while adding, Mr. Kelly is leaving after a 17-month tenure that he described to the paper as a bone-crushing hard job. Mr. Kelly was known to tell aides that he had the worst job in the world and frequently told people that Mr. Trump was not up to the role of president, according to two former administration officials. Earlier, it was reported that White House Chief of Staff John Kelly will be leaving the Trump administration on Wednesday after serving 18 months on the job, wrangling President Trump and keeping the West Wing in order. In an exclusive two-hour interview with the LA Times, Kelly offers a peek behind the curtain as he presided over some of the Trump administration's most controversial immigration and geopolitical policies. When I first took over, he was inclined to want to withdraw from Afghanistan, Kelly recalled. He was frustrated. It was a huge decision to make. And frankly, there was no system at all for a lot of reasons. Palace intrigue and the rest of it when I got there. Wow, so Trump wanted to withdraw from Afghanistan. Folks, Trump is the real deal. And all these tards out here talking about how he's some George W. Bush puppet of the Israelis, it's simply not true. It's overblown. Where are the neocons in his administration? Does he have Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Bill Kristol, Charles Kraut? Krauthammer's dead now, thank God. Wormser, Feith, who else? Rumsfeld, Cheney. Does he have these same rats in his administration? No. He has John Bolton, very true, but that's one guy. Trump is the boss, folks. Trump don't take no shit. Trump is the boss. Continuing on, Trump, who campaigned on non-interventionism and reducing troop counts wherever possible, announced the pullout of all U.S. troops from Syria and half of the 14,000 troops in Afghanistan after Kelly's departure was confirmed on December 8th, moves that Kelly opposed as chief of staff. Well, Kelly, you can go get bent. Kelly's supporters, meanwhile, have suggested that he was the only thing stopping Trump from making several ill-advised choices. Let's put that in air quotes. Ill-advised choices. Read, Israel didn't want it, such as not pulling U.S. forces out of South Korea and not withdrawing from NATO as Trump has threatened. That said, the outgoing chief of staff maintains that President Trump had access to multiple streams of detailed info before major decisions were made, despite Trump's reputation for relying on his gut instinct. Well, that's another thing, folks. They just lie about Trump so much, they act like, oh, he doesn't read anything. He doesn't study anything. All he does is drink Diet Cokes and order people about. That's not true at all. Here's a quote from Kelly. It's never been The president just wants to make a decision based on no knowledge and ignorance. You may not like his decision, but at least he was fully informed on the impact. So here you have it, butthurt John Kelly, even contradicting reports that Trump doesn't read anything and doesn't get any info before he makes a decision. Trump is fully aware of what the impact and consequences are going to be when he makes a decision. Bone-crushing. Kelly tells the Times that it was a bone-crushing hard job to have spent nearly every waking minute of 15-hour days with the president, but you do it, he added. On most days, he said, he woke up at 4 a.m. and typically came home at 9 p.m. Then he often went straight into a secure area for classified reports and communications so he could keep working. I'm guarded by the Secret Service. I can't even go get a beer, he quipped. That's from the LA Times. Kelly also noted that while Trump pushed back on his advisors to test the limits of his authority under the law, often asking Kelly, why can't we do it this way? That Trump never ordered him to do anything illegal because he wouldn't have it. Oh, I'm sorry, not to do anything illegal because he wouldn't have. He wouldn't have done anything illegal. If he had said to me, do it or you're fired, Kelly said, he would have resigned. According to Kelly, Trump brought him in to bring structure and order to a chaotic White House racked with interagency rivalry, remarkably high staff turnover, and nearly constant controversy, adding that he tried to remove politics from his decision-making. I told the president the last thing, in my view, that you need in the chief of staff is someone that looks at every issue through a political lens, Kelly said. Here's an excerpt from the LA Times. Kelly served 46 years in the Marines, from the Vietnam War to the rise of the Islamic State, making him the U.S. military's longest-serving general when he retired in January 2016. When Trump picked him to head Homeland Security and then serve as White House Chief of Staff, officials from the Pentagon to Capitol Hill expressed hope that Kelly would be one of the adults in the room to manage a mercurial president. Oh, yes, I know. Anyway, to critics, Kelly failed at that task, unable to rein in Trump's angry tweets or bring order to executive decision-making. Worse, they argue, he aggressively advocated and implemented harsh immigration measures, including separating migrant children from their parents on the border last summer that quickly ran around or were reversed in the courts. Kelly brushed off reports that Trump was put off by Kelly's iron grip on White House operations or the endless briefings. However, his anticlimactic exit, as the Times put it, reflects a tenure dogged from the outset by the indignities of constant speculation, fueled by the president's own public remarks that he would be fired. Kelly said that the decision to leave was solidified after the November 6 midterm election, in which Republicans lost control of the House. 2 days later, Trump announced Kelly's departure. John Kelly will be leaving. I don't know if I can say retiring, Trump said from the South Lawn of the White House before departing for the annual Army-Navy football game. But he's a great guy. Unlike Kelly's friend, James Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, the retired Marine general who resigned as Secretary of Defense with a public letter rebuking the president for abandoning allies and undermining alliances, Kelly kept his counsel. But his impending departure from the eye of the storm created an embarrassing void at the White House as one candidate after another publicly pulled out or declined the chief of staff job. The departure of Kelly has many in Washington worried that nobody will be watching Trump, mostly among Democrats. Now it just seems to be a free-for-all, said Senator Jack Reed from Rhode Island. There's no real consistent figure that's going to stand there and just make sure, literally, the train runs on time. I think that was one of Kelly's major contributions. It's a loss, there's no question, said Senator Dianne Feinstein. Kelly leaves amid a stalemate of over $5 billion in funding for Trump's U.S.-Mexico border wall, which has resulted in a government shutdown now entering week two. Trump has blamed Democrats who have refused to provide more than $1.3 billion for border security. To be honest, it's not a wall, said Kelly, who embarked in early 2017 on seeking advice from those who actually secure the border on what to do. Speaking with Customs and Border Protection agents, referred to by Kelly as salt-of-the-earth Joe Sixpack folks, the outgoing chief of staff recounts, they said, "Well, we need a physical barrier in certain places, we need technology across the board, and we need more people." The president still says wall. Oftentimes, frankly, he'll say barrier or fencing. Now he's tended towards steel slats. But we left a solid concrete wall early on in the administration when we asked people what they needed and where they needed it. When pressed by the Times over whether there is a security crisis at the southern border or if Trump simply stirred up fears of a migrant invasion, Kelly said, "We do have an immigrant problem." From the 1980s to the mid-2000s, apprehensions at the border, the most common measure of illegal immigration, routinely reached more than 1 million migrants a year. Folks, are you listening to this? Here they're admitting, the LA Times admits, from the 80s to the mid-2000s, let's say 20, 25 years, a million migrants, quote-unquote migrants, I would say illegal alien invaders, coming to suck up our public funds system. More than a million migrants for 25 years poured into the country. Today, they are near historical lows. In the fiscal year that ended in September, border authorities apprehended 521,090 people. But immigration officials are seeing a dramatic rise in families and unaccompanied minors at the border, mostly from Central America. Kelly saw the corruption and violence that spurred migrations from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, first as head of the Pentagon's Southern Command, which stretches from South America to Mexico's southern border, then at Homeland Security. He says that experience has given him a nuanced view on immigration and border security, one that at times appears at odds with Trump's harsh anti-immigration messaging and policy. Illegal immigrants overwhelmingly are not bad people, Kelly said, describing many migrants as victims misled by traffickers. I have nothing but compassion for them, the young kids. Kelly laid blame on immigrants and lawmakers and not the Trump administration for the tense situation at the border in which thousands of Central Americans remain stranded at the southern U.S. border, waiting for asylum claims to be processed at a snail's pace of less than 100 per day. One of the reasons why it's so difficult to keep people from coming, obviously it'd be preferable for them to stay in their own homeland, but it's difficult to do sometimes where they live, is a crazy, oftentimes conflicting series of loopholes in the law in the U.S. that makes it extremely hard to turn people around and send them home, said Kelly. If we don't fix the laws, then they'll keep coming, he continued. They have known, and they do know, that if they can get here, they can, generally speaking, stay. Kelly's advice to stop illegal immigration? Stop U.S. demand for drugs and expand economic opportunity in Central America, he said. Well, gee, maybe we can go invade Central America and build their goddamn nations now, too. All on white taxpayers' dime. Gee, doesn't that sound like a good idea? Get rid of goddamn drug prohibition. If people want to shoot heroin in their veins and snort cocaine until they rot away and die, let them. You are not going to stop them. Maybe we should outlaw liquor, just like they did in the 1920s, and we can have, Al Capone gangs in black dindus in Chicago killing each other over liquor sales and drug liquor corner trafficking stops. Maybe we can bring that back, too. I don't necessarily disagree with John Kelly, but expand economic opportunity in Central America. What? Is that our responsibility now? John Kelly dinged the Trump administration for failing to appropriately predict the public outrage stemming from Steve Bannon's travel ban in January 2017, as well as the zero-tolerance immigration policy and resultant spike in family separations this year. Shortly after taking office, Trump issued an executive order immediately suspending the entire U.S. refugee program for 120 days, indefinitely freezing the entry of refugees from Syria and barring travelers from seven Muslim-majority countries. Refugees already approved for resettlement, green card holders, and others were turned away from flights, detained, and in some cases deported. Federal judges issued emergency stays, and several iterations of the travel ban have been challenged in court. At the time, despite reports he'd been caught off guard by the president's order, Kelly gave a full-throated defense. "I had very little opportunity to look at them," before the orders were announced, Kelly acknowledged in his Times interview. Obviously, it brought down a greater deal of thunder on the president. Blaine Rathmeyer, who helped shepherd Kelly and his replacement at Homeland Security, Kristen Nielsen, through their Senate confirmations, put it more colorfully. He got handed a crap sandwich the first week of the job. "There's only so many things a chief of staff can do, particularly with a personality like Donald Trump," said former Kelly colleague David Lappin of the Bipartisan Policy Center. In May, then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced a zero-tolerance immigration policy which resulted in the high-profile separation of migrant children from their parents, a practice conducted under the Obama administration, which even the ACLU sued them over. Kelly said Sessions' announcement surprised the White House. What happened was Jeff Sessions, he was the one that instituted the zero-tolerance process on the border that resulted in both people being detained and family separation, said Kelly. He surprised us. The task of implementing the policy fell on the shoulders of Kelly's replacement at the Department of Homeland Security, Kristen Nielsen, who came under fire for claiming that there was no official policy of separating families. "She's a good soldier. She took the face shot," said an anonymous senior White House official to the Times. "No one asked her to do it, but by the time we could put together a better strategy, she already owned it." When asked why he stuck it out for 18 months in the chaotic Trump White House, despite policy differences, personality clashes, the punishing schedule, and a likely lasting association with some of Trump's controversies, Kelly said it was a matter of duty. "Military people," said Kelly, "don't walk away." Well, there you have it, folks. John Kelly, do I know much about him? No, I can't say that I do. I here at America Betrayed, I wish I could devote my full-time working hours to this. Unfortunately, I've had other employment obligations to tend to. I hope in the future that you guys will support me. You guys will subscribe to the podcast. You'll buy the products where I can essentially live my dream of doing this full time. I really hope it. I hope you guys enjoy this. I hope you find value in it. And I hope I can dedicate my time to educating you folks 24/7 on these sort of matters and entertain you in the process. Well, 1,400 comments under this. "Trump has gone to the military to fill his cabinet, I think, in part, partially, to avoid the bureaucrats and the hawks, the neocons from George W. Bush's administration. It's very possible he knows he needs to stay away from those people and has gone with voices of sanity from the military, who can be relied upon and who are competent." It was people like, who was it, General Shinseki, Colin Powell, Richard Armitage, who were the only voices of sanity in the George W. Bush administration, the only ones saying we need to pump the brakes on toppling Saddam, on these Middle East wars. And it was the Israeli first policy people like Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Richard Pearl, David Wormser, Michael Ledeen, William Crystal, Charles Krauthammer, and the rest of the neocons. Who else am I missing? Did I say Wolfowitz, Pearl, Rumsfeld, Cheney? Those are the people pushing for this war policy. The policy coup that Wesley Clark talked about. The policy coup! And then he conveniently forgot to tell us that it was all in Israel's interest. Remember that? Well, I think Trump knows he's going to go with military people, that they're more reliable, they're more independent, they're more impartial, and they don't have some foreign policy agenda. And they've been in the military. They probably are reluctant to jeopardize our troops. And I think that's the approach. Now, Alex Jones claims that the Trump presidency and candidacy was a project of military intelligence and taking the country back from the deep staters, from Obama Clinton cabal, from all these folks. But is that exactly accurate? I don't know. Jones and InfoWars and all these alt media people will not tell you the truth about the strings that Israel pulls and how they get their policy implemented. They own Capitol Hill. They own Congress. They own our representatives. They own our senators with campaign contribution bribes and threats of branding people as anti-Semitic. And they've got a hold on us. It's not necessarily China. It's not necessarily the Muslims. It's not the liberals. It's not the warmongers. It's Israeli interests that own our government. Simply put, that much ought to be obvious. And of course, me and a handful of other people on the internet, the others been around a lot longer than I have been talking about it. And they're the only ones, folks. All right, we're going to take a pause here, and then we'll move on to the next news items of the day. Here's a good one. This is from Phil Giraldi, who does great work that is usually featured over at the UNS Review. This is from the 29th of December. This is the Mattis Dilemma. The resignation letter of Secretary of Defense James Mattis, that was published last Thursday, revealed much of the deep state mindset that has produced the foreign policy catastrophes of the past 17 years. Mattis, an active duty general in the Marine Corps who reportedly occasionally reads books, received a lot of good press during his time at defense, sometimes being referred to as the only adult in the room when President Donald Trump's national security team and foreign policy team was meeting. Conveniently forgotten are Mattis comments relating to how to be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everyone you meet. His nickname, of course, from the Marine Corps was Mad Dog. In the media firestorm that has followed upon General Mattis's resignation, he has been generally lauded as a highly experienced and respected leader who has numerous friends on both sides of the aisle in Congress. Of course, the press coverage should be taken with a grain of salt, as it is designed less to praise Mattis and more to get at Trump over the decision to leave Syria, which is being assailed by both neoliberals and neoconservatives who believe that war is the health of the state. Well, being in Israel's good graces is the health of the state, my friend. That's what keeps the campaign contributions rolling in for congressmen, don't you know? The arguments against the Trump decisions to depart from Syria and downsize in Afghanistan are contrived for the most part and based on the premise that American intervention in places that Washington deems not to be sufficiently promoting democracy, the rule of law, and free trade is a good thing. Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, put it nicely when discussing the reaction in the media. Trump's critics will have the vapors about losing ground to Russia, making Iran's day, and abdicating influence, but their criticism is ill-founded. Contrary to their apparent belief, the U.S. does not have a God-given right to send its forces anywhere on the planet it deems fit. Withdrawal will see the U.S. in one respect at least follow the international rules-based system we're so fond of in joining on others, and will therefore be a victory of sorts for upholders of international law. The central argument of the Mattis resignation letter that is being cited by critics relates to Washington's relationship with the rest of the world and is framed as a failure by President Trump to understand who are friends and who are enemies. Mattis wrote, "One core belief I have always held is that our strength as a nation is inextricably linked to the strength of our unique and comprehensive system of alliances and partnerships. While the U.S. remains the indispensable nation in the free world, we cannot protect our interests or serve that role effectively without maintaining strong alliances and showing respect to those allies." Similarly, I believe we must be resolute and unambiguous in our approach to those countries whose strategic interests are increasingly in tension with ours. It is clear that Russia and China, for example, want to shape a world consistent with their authoritarian model, gaining veto authority over other nations' economic, diplomatic, and security decisions to promote their own interests at the expense of their neighbors, America, and our allies. That is why we must use all the tools of American power to provide for the common defense. My views on treating allies with respect and also being clear-eyed about both malign actors and strategic competitors are strongly held and informed by over four decades of immersion in these issues. We must do everything possible to advance an international order that is most conducive to our security, prosperity, and values, and we're strengthened in this effort by the solidarity of our alliances. General Mattis does indeed hold views that were shaped by four decades of experience, but most of it was bad and produced wrong conclusions about America's place in the world. The Cold War was essentially a bipolar conflict pitting two adversaries that had the ability to destroy all life on the planet. It generated a Manichean point of view on good versus evil that did not reflect reality, which was succeeded by a global war on terror declared by Washington that also exploited the good and evil paradigm. Mattis was a product of that kind of thinking, which was also fueled by the concept of American exceptionalism, which saw the United States as the proper promoter and enforcer of universal values. There is, of course, another viewpoint, which is that American blundering and use of force as a first option has, in fact, created the current dystopia. The United States is not currently venerated as a force for good. Quite the opposite. Opinion polls suggest that Washington is overwhelmingly viewed negatively worldwide, and it is perceived as being the nation most likely to start wars. That's not exactly what the nation's founders envisioned back in 1783. Trump is right about leaving Syria, where nothing beyond prolonging the bloody conflict is being accomplished. Mattis is wrong about supporting, quote, friends. For an educated man, he misreads history. The First World War and Second World War developed as they did because of alliances. Countries that appear friendly can exploit relationships, Israel, with other more powerful nations that will have devastating results. Alliances should be temporary, coming and going based on the interests of the nations involved. In the Mideast, Israel and Saudi Arabia are not actually friends of the U.S. and are engaged instead in manipulating Washington to suit their own purposes. Mattis does not understand that and sees a permanent state of war requiring the continued existence of NATO, for example, as a vehicle for deterrence and peace. It is neither. Its very existence depends on a perception of being threatened even where no threat exists, which has poisoned the relationship with Russia since the fall of communism. Worse still, the false perception of threat can lead to war and a global nuclear holocaust. Well, Phil Giraldi is exactly right. And I'm not too confident in Jim Mattis's self-proclaimed ability to understand history and that he knows all this. I think Mattis is a fool for one reason in particular, and it's the same reason that almost everyone else is a fool. He doesn't understand that the U.S. is being used as a whore by the Israelis to accomplish Israeli strategic objectives in the Middle East. America is not profiting and it's not securing itself by agitating against Muslims and fighting Israel's wars in the Middle East. It's not helping us. We're ruining our quote, empire that we inherited in 1945, we're ruining the vitality of our nation. We're ruining the goose that lays the golden egg by oppressing the white tax-paying worker base who find themselves economically, financially strapped to the point where having children is out of the question because they can't afford it. They can't even get by as it is. Who's going to fight these wars in the next 20, 30 years? The white Southern soldier, I argue, me being a Yankee, is the best soldier on the planet. The white Southerner who grew up hunting, who grew up as an outdoorsman, grew up with working class blue collar values, duty, discipline, honor. And you aren't going to have Jim Mattis. You aren't going to have any more of these folks to fight your wars and be competent on the battlefield in the future. You're ruining the country. You think you're a know-it-all, and you're really a fool. And I think you're a soldier's general. I think you're best used on the battlefield. I don't think you're a strategic thinker. I think you're a warrior. You're supposed to be leading troops, and that's your thing. That's your niche. I've never heard Jim Mattis talk about Israel's influence on Washington, D.C. for the worst. If we weren't controlled by Israel and Capitol Hill and our media and these goddamn whorehouse churches in America, we would not have had, 4,500, 5,000 troops dead in Iraq and Afghanistan in the past 17 years, and who knows how many tens of thousands damaged, wounded, suicides. I don't even know what the count is. And it really is similar. You can say it's really no different from Korea, from Vietnam. Same thing. American kids dead for what? Other people's borders. Other people's security interests. When will America wake up? When will white people wake up and realize they're being exploited? I don't know. I don't think it's... At this point, if it was going to happen, it would have happened. But then again... everyone's relatively fat and happy with full bellies and entertained, even though they're living paycheck to paycheck and they're one missed paycheck away from living out of a dumpster on the side of the road. They're still not mad enough, still not destitute enough to do anything about it. And even if they wanted to do something about it, I don't think they have the intelligence to put all the pieces together and find a suitable solution. I really don't. being in the bowel movement, the truth movement, for in and around for, well, I first read a book about 9/11 roughly 14, 15 years ago. It's just full of idiots and douchebags and ladder climbers and self-promoters and egomaniacs and know-it-alls and charlatans and con men and I don't know. I'm not very hopeful about our prospects to turn things around because I don't see any intelligent people on the horizon leading the way. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm short-sighted and I'm missing a lot. Well, we're talking about Syria, talking about Trump. Let's read a piece, and I don't totally agree with this. I'm going to tell you, as another nation, starts with an I and ends with an L in the Middle East, our only friend and ally, the only democracy in the Middle East that got us into these wars in the Mideast, and particularly in Syria. And even had policy papers in the 90s with Bill Kristol and Project for a New American Century and A Clean Break, Securing the Realm, where they specifically named toppling Syria, occupying Syria. All right, here's the story. This is from the 27th of December. This is from Eric Zeus, from the Strategic Culture Foundation, reposted on Zero Hedge, who was secretly behind America's invading and occupying Syria. The invasion and occupation of Syria by tens of thousands of jihadists who were recruited from around the world to overthrow Syria's President Bashar al-Assad was financed mainly by U.S. taxpayers and by the world's wealthiest family, the Sauds, who own Saudi Arabia and the world's largest oil company, Aramco. Now, Eric, let me stop you. Are the Saudis, the Sauds, the House of Saud, are they really the wealthiest family? I think there's another family. It starts with an R, goes into Auth, and ends in Child, who are the wealthiest family in the world. But that's just me and my tinfoil hat. Continuing on, America's international oil companies and major think tanks and charitable foundations were also supportive in providing propaganda for the operation, but the main financing for it came from America's taxpayers and from the Saud family and from the government that they own. One of the best articles that the New York Times ever published was by Mark Mazzetti and Matt Apuzzo on January 23, 2016, entitled, U.S. Relies Heavily on Saudi Money to Support Syrian Rebels. Both Matt and Mark reported that the CIA and its Saudi counterpart have maintained an unusual arrangement for the rebel training mission, which the Americans have codenamed Timber Sycamore. Under the deal, current and former administration officials said, the Saudis contribute both weapons and large sums of money, and the CIA takes the lead in training the rebels. From the moment the CIA operation was started, Saudi money supported it. Furthermore, the White House has embraced the covert financing from Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Jordan and Turkey. But American officials said Saudi Arabia was by far the largest contributor to the operation. The invasion and occupation of Syria by jihadists from around the world was primarily a Saudi operation, though it was managed mainly by the U.S. government. Prior to the failed U.S. coup attempt on July 15, 2015, to replace Tayyip Erdogan as Turkey's president, Turkey was part of the U.S.-Saudi alliance to overthrow and replace Syria's government. But afterwards, Turkey increasingly switched against the U.S. and Sauds, and toward instead supporting the target of the Sauds and America's aristocrats, Syria. And so, Turkey has increasingly joined Syria's alliance, which includes Iran and Russia. That's one of the major geopolitical changes in recent decades. And why did that happen, folks? Because we tried to overthrow him. Folks, if the Jews in the U.S. and the Saudis turned on you and tried to murder you and turn your country over to your enemies, wouldn't you turn on them too? I would. The New York Times continued reporting saying this: the Saudi efforts were led by the flamboyant Prince Bandar bin Sultan, at the time the intelligence chief who directed Saudi spies to buy thousands of AK-47s and millions of rounds of ammo in Eastern Europe for the Syrian rebels. The CIA helped arrange some of the arms purchases for the Saudis, including a large deal in Croatia in 2012. The U.S. preferred to be supplying the jihadists weapons that weren't from U.S. manufacturers in order to impede any tracing back to the U.S., the arming of the movement to oust and replace Syria's secular, committedly non-sectarian government. Yep, this is Iraq War, the toppling of Saddam Hussein 2.0. You're going to get rid of an Arab secular strongman, and you're going to put in its place head-chopping radical Islamic fundamentalist fanatics. The Sauds, who are just as committedly sectarian and even supporters of the extreme fundamentalist Wahhabist sect of Sunni Islam, likewise tried to cover their tracks in this operation, but their tracks were financial. The Sauds have been especially skillful at covering their tracks. Prince Bandar bin Sultan Al Saud was a buddy of George W. Bush and had secretly donated over $1 million in cash to Al-Qaeda prior to the 9/11 attacks, according to Osama bin Laden's financial bagman, who had picked up personally each one of the $1 million cash donations to that organization until 9/11, and who named amongst those donors not only Prince Bandar, but also Prince Salman Al Saud, who subsequently became King Salman, who is now the father of Crown Prince Salman, who recently murdered the columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Crown Prince Salman is also a close friend of America's current prince, Jared Kushner, the U.S. president's son-in-law. You know, let me stop. Daniel Hopsicker reported that, there's some Jewish mob figure in South Florida who has a daughter or a son married, it must be a daughter now I think about it, married to a Saudi, a member of the royal Saudi family, and I cannot, Alvin Melnick, that's the name. There you go. There's some homework for you. Google that name. Alvin Melnick. Have some fun. Continuing on. So the Saud family are very close with America's Republican aristocrats, perhaps even closer than they are with America's Democratic aristocrats. But especially because of the business links, the Sauds are deeply influential throughout America's aristocracy. Not only is Saudi Arabia the world's most oil-rich country, but it is also the world's largest purchaser of weapons from Lockheed Martin and other American defense contractors, which sell exclusively to the U.S. government and to the governments that are allied with it, like Saudi Arabia. So, those corporations depend upon the Sauds more than any other family, even than any single American family. The Saud family are also crucial allies with Israel's aristocracy. Gee, what a surprise. Who include American billionaires such as the Republican Sheldon Adelson and the Democrat Leslie Wexner. Prince Bandar was also reported by the FBI to have financed directly from his personal checking account the U.S. stays and the pilot training of at least two of the 15 Saudis who were among the 19 jihadists who carried out the piloting and plane hijackings on 9/11. So, if Bandar didn't perhaps in consultation with George W. Bush, actually planned those attacks himself, he at least was one of their chief financial backers. The NYT article also mentioned that in late 2012, according to two former senior American officials, David H. Petraeus, then the CIA director, delivered a stern lecture to intelligence officials of several Gulf nations at a meeting near the Dead Sea in Jordan. He chastised them for sending arms into Syria without coordinating with one another or with CIA officers in Jordan and Turkey. Months later, Mr. Obama gave his approval for the CIA to begin directly arming and training the rebels from a base in Jordan, amending the Timber Sycamore program to allow lethal assistance. Under the new arrangement, the CIA took the lead in training, while Saudi Arabia's intelligence agency, the General Intelligence Directorate, provided money and weapons, including Tau tank missiles, so as to conquer Syria for the Sauds. Folks, if you didn't know, the Arabs, the different clans of the Arabs and some of the non-Arab tribes, like Persians and Kurds, I mean, they all hate each other worse than they hate the Israelis. What does that tell you? These authors were, however, misguided when they wrote that while the intelligence alliance is central to the Syria fight and has been important in the war against Al-Qaeda, a constant irritant in American-Saudi relations is just how much Saudi citizens continue to support terror groups, analysts said. That support, quote-unquote, to jihadists, to the extent that it was financial, came actually not from Saudi citizens, but from the Saudi aristocracy, mainly from the Saud family itself. Moreover, in a monarchy, which Saudi Arabia is, there are no actual citizens. There are only the monarch and his or her subjects, not citizens. Citizens such as exist in a democracy, even it's only a so-called one, even if it's only a so-called democracy. There are only the monarch and his or her subjects, especially in an absolute monarchy such as Saudi Arabia. So that term, citizens, was a false and misleading term in that context. On March 6, 2013, Britain's Guardian bannered regarding General Petraeus, this article, from El Salvador to Iraq, Washington's man behind brutal police squads, and reported his having created the death squads in El Salvador and designed the post-Saddam Iraqi torture program for trying to extract from detainees, although the Guardian failed to note this, whatever information they might have about Saddam Hussein's role in the 9/11 attacks. Nothing was mentioned in the Guardian about 9/11, but only that the aim to halt a nascent Sunni insurgency in its tracks by extracting information from detainees, but nothing was said there about what type of information was being sought or why. With Petraeus's almost unlimited access to money and weapons and Steele's field experience in counterinsurgency, the stage was set for the commandos to emerge as a terrifying force. But force for what? The Guardian offered nothing on that. Terry Mason, at VoltaireNet on May 9th, 2011, headlined What You Don't Know About the Bilderberg Group, and he wrote this: The operation was controlled in reality by William J. Donovan, Bill Donovan, the former OSS commander, now in charge of building the American branch of the new Secret Service of NATO, Gladio. Moreover, the security of each subsequent meeting was not provided by the police of the host country, but by the soldiers of the NATO alliance. Terry Mason said that Henry Kissinger is the main person responsible for invitations to the Bilderberg Group. Another of the core group was Henry R. Kravis, U.S. financier, investment fund manager of KKR. He's a major fundraiser for the Republican Party. Mason called this the lobby of the most powerful military organization in the world, NATO. Furthermore, During the last U.S. presidential elections, it was reported that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton disappeared on June 6, 2008, in order to negotiate an end to the rivalry. In reality, they participated in the annual conference of the Bilderberg Group in Chantilly, Virginia. The following day, Mrs. Clinton announced that she was retiring from the race. According to our sources, something else happened. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton concluded a financial and political agreement. Senator Obama bailed out his rival financially and offered her a position in his administration. Clinton refused the vice presidency and instead chose the State Department in exchange for her active support during the campaign against McCain. Then, the two leaders were presented by James A. Johnson to the Bilderberg Conference, where they assured the participants that they would work together. Hillary had a solid record and reputation as a neoconservative and as a supporter of overthrowing Syria's government. Barack Obama had already been NATO's candidate for a long time, but his campaign rhetoric had nonetheless caused worries among the establishment. Mr. Obama and his family have always worked for the CIA and the Pentagon. Moreover, the initial funds for his campaign were provided by the Crown of England via a businessman named Nadmi Auchi. In presenting the black senator to the Bilderbergers, the Atlantic Alliance was, in fact, organizing public relations at the international level for the future president of the United States. Well, that's somewhat new to me. I thought Obama was backed by the Crown family, the Jewish family from Chicago. Interesting. Okay, that's the end of that excerpt. Of course, back to the text here, that was even before Obama had won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. On December 11th, 2018, Maison headlined, "Whom does Emmanuel Macron owe?" And he wrote that he owes his electoral campaign mostly to Henry Kravis, the boss of one of the world's largest financial companies, and to NATO, a considerable debt which weighs heavily today on the solution to the Yellow Vests crisis. Macron had first met Henry and Marie José Kravis in their residence on Park Avenue in New York. This meeting probably took place in 2007. Thereafter, Emmanuel Macron systematically visited the Kravis couple whenever he was in the USA, and Henry Kravis welcomed him in his offices on Avenue Montaigne when he visited Paris. The Kravis couple, unfailing supporters of the U.S. Republican Party, are among the great world fortunes who play politics out of sight of the press. Furthermore, in December 2014, Henry Kravis created his own intelligence agency, the KKR Global Institute. He nominated at its head the ex-director of the CIA, General David Petraeus. With the Kravis couple's private funds, that being the KKR investment funds, and without referring to Congress, Petraeus pursued Operation Timber Sycamore, which had been initiated by President Barack Obama. This was the largest weapons traffic in history, implicating at least 17 states and representing many thousands of tons of weapons worth several billion dollars. As such, Kravis and Petraeus became the main suppliers for Daesh, which is like al-Nusra ISIS, guys, as far as I understand it. On June 6th, 2017, Terry Maison headlined another article entitled "Confrontation at Bilderberg 2017," and he wrote, "There exists no photographs of the meeting of the Bilderberg Group, whose work is confidential. Security for the meeting is not handled by the FBI nor the Virginia Police Force, but by a private militia organized by NATO. The Bilderberg Group was created in 1954 by the CIA and MI6 in order to support the Atlantic Alliance." The 2017 meeting is also described there. Among the board of directors, mostly international corporate luminaries, was Marie-José Drouin Kravis, economic columnist in print and broadcast media in Canada, researcher at the very militaristic Hudson Institute. She is the third wife of Henry Kravis. Both Petraeus and his two KKR sponsors are regular attendees at the Bilderberg meetings. What financial stake, if any, in assisting the Sauds to take over Syria KKR has is not known. But if there is such, then the U.S. government's recent decision to quit its military occupation of Syria will presumably be, to that extent, unfavorable for the KKR and unpopular among the 150 companies in which it holds stock. The great investigative journalists Diliana Gaitanzieva, Andre Fulman, Manlio DiNucci, Terry Mason, and the South Front site have, in several articles, documented that the governments of the U.S., the UAE, Qatar, and mainly Saudi Arabia are financing and overseeing a billion-dollar privately operated weapons smuggling operation to Sunni jihadist groups such as Al-Qaeda in Africa, the Middle East, Pakistan, and Asia. Terry Mason writes, in less than 3 years, Silkway Airlines transported at least $1 billion worth of armaments. One thing leading to another, journalist Diliana Gaitanzieva uncovered a vast system which also supplied the jihadists not only in Iraq and Syria, but also in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Congo, also paid for by the Saudis and the Emiratis. I guess that's the UAE people. Some of the arms delivered in Arabia were redirected to South Africa. Let me read that one again. Some of the arms delivered in Arabia were redirected to South Africa. Who are they going to in South Africa, the whites or the blacks? That's my question. The arms transported to Afghanistan were delivered to the Taliban's under the control of the U.S., which is pretending to fight them. Here's an excerpt. Although, according to the international treaties, neither civil nor diplomatic flights are authorized to carry military material, requests for recognition as diplomatic flights require the explicit detailing of the cargo transported. However, at the request of the U.S. State Department, at least Afghanistan, Germany, Saudi Arabia, Bulgaria, Congo, UAE, Hungary, Israel, Pakistan, Poland, Romania, Serbia, Slovakia, Czech Republic, Turkey, and the UK closed their eyes to this violation of international law, just as they had ignored the CIA flights to and from their secret prisons. According to Sibel Edmonds, ex-FBI agent and founder of the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, Azerbaijan, under President Heydar Aliyev, from 1997 to 2001, hosted in Baku the number two of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri. This was done at the request of the CIA. Although officially wanted by the FBI, the man who was then the number two of the International Jihadist Network traveled regularly in NATO planes to Afghanistan, Albania, Egypt, and Turkey. He also received frequent visits from Prince Bandar bin Sultan of Saudi Arabia. God, unbelievable. International relations are controlled by international corporations, but the identities of the persons who control those are often hidden. So, it's not easy to say whom has been enriched by the invasion and occupation of Syria. And probably there won't be funding for investigative journalists to do the costly research to find out whom those persons actually are. But they are controlled by both Obama and Trump, both of whom carried out their policy on Syria. Well, you can't blame Trump no more, my friend. Eric Zeuss. I'm going to spell the last name. Z-U-E-S-S-E. Zeuss? I'm butchering that, but look, I disagree. Donald Trump is not down with the cause in Syria to supply ISIS and overthrow Bashar al-Assad and carry out the Israeli agenda that Netanyahu so wants him to. That's why he's public enemy number one. That's why there's a witch hunt campaign to get rid of this guy, to impeach him. And the liberals are so stupid, they're just eating it up. Mike Pence is going to be a bigger neocon than Donald Trump. Which is why the Israelis want him impeached. They want Mike Pence to be their whipping boy, their errand boy, and to deliver unto Zion. That's what they want. Interesting. So Saudi connections to Al-Qaeda, and that's all interesting, and I'm sure. I'm sure a lot of that is accurate, but look, with Saudi Arabia carrying out espionage activities in the U.S. prior to and on 9/11, were Saudi companies, did they have a backdoor into the telecom communications across the entire country via Amdocs and billing all the telecom companies? Was that a Saudi Arabian company doing that? Did a Saudi Arabian company warn Saudis that the World Trade Center was going to be attacked hours before the planes crashed? Were Saudi Arabians penetrating DEA offices and casing military bases and caught with blueprints for nuclear power plant sites in Florida and fake IDs in Tennessee? Were five Saudi Arabians dancing, high-fiving, and filming the attacks and actually filming the first plane hitting the tower from across the Hudson River in New Jersey, dressed up as Arabs, dancing with vans that had thousands of dollars of cash, fake passports, fake IDs, and bomb residue in the van? And later, one of the vans actually blew up. It's on the police transmission recording from that day. One of the vans blew up. They were trying to blow up the George Washington Bridge and got caught. You know, folks, there's so much to cover up with Israel and how they control us and how they were behind 9/11. And, you know, they probably tricked Saudi Arabians and these other Arab people into sending money. You know, the Jews never do, the Israelis never do their own dirty work. Did the Israelis send the IDF in to topple Saddam and get rid of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq? No, they get other people to do the dirty work. They frame other people for crimes. It's very simple. And I would suppose that somehow, you know, and two, the Arabs, like I said, the Arabs and the non-Arab tribes that inhabit the Middle East, the Kurds, Turks, the Persians, and the others, you know, they all hate each other. It kind of reminds me of that passage in the Bible that Ishmael will be a wild man and his hand will be against everyone else's. And it certainly seems to ring true. If the inhabitants of Arabia today are the true sons and daughters of Ishmael, and Ishmael was a wild man, well, it certainly makes sense, the lineage, because they are wild, warlike, they hate each other, and they all hate each other and want to kill each other worse than they want to kill Americans and Israelis in the Middle East, it seems to me. Well, I'll tell you what, this is, we're at the end of the news coverage for this episode. Again, this is Ted signing off for AmericaBetrayed.us. Go to the site, check it out, register, subscribe to the podcast. You're not going to want to miss what we go through every day. We're going to go through the news. We're not going to be like Alex Jones and all these other liars in the alternative media that won't call a spade, won't tell you all the news, and get up on TV and broadcast and cry for Benjamin Netanyahu and pray for him and all this sort of stuff. The bullshit stops, folks. This is the real deal. Subscribe to the podcast. This is Ted signing off. Praise Christ. Praise God. God bless you all. Take care. Keep your eyes open and your head up, folks.